Listener Production.
You are listening to episode 29 of the Howie Games Artist Series Part B with Jack McCoy. Do not forget Jack and Ockie's tour of the Ockumentary through May on the east coast of Australia. All the details on jackmccoy.com. Jackmccoy.com. Good times. So a typical, you know, Tubular Swells runs an hour and a half. Give me an average. How many hours of footage would you shoot to turn out an hour and a half surf film?
Roughly speaking, you do 20 to 1.
20 to 1. Okay.
So a feature film, you have to remember that you could only get 45 minutes on one reel.
Yeah.
So you'd have to have an intermission to change the reels. So in 45 minutes, you're in 3,000 feet. It is 3,000 feet. So multiply that times 20 is how many feet of film. Jeez. You would shoot roughly 20 to 1. Because a lot of waves, you button on and the guy falls off, or it's not that great a ride, or you pick the wrong guy. But basically 20 to 1.
Okay, so 20 to 1. You're there and you've got budget and you've got expense and you've got people as you start to progress, and you get into a situation where you go to spot X and for 6 days there's no surf. How does a filmmaker with budgets and expenses deal with a situation like that?
Good question. Back in the day before surf reports.
Yeah.
I would plan a trip and I would go there until I got it.
Okay.
until I got a good day or something.
Right.
Now, having said that, I always would, during the ordinary days, shoot something. Small day, not that big, a little bit onshore, whatever. I would shoot something. I called that my insurance footage, just so I would always be able to come back with something. Classic example is the Green Iguana. I took Aki there.
Yep.
And I took my wife and a couple of friends and Sonny Garcia, and we ended up 2-week trip, and all we got was a couple onshore days. Sonny and Aki ripped. Huh. I shot some really good sequences. I had this footage, but I wasn't leaving because I'd been there the year before and knew how good the wave was. So my wife and my child and Sonny and my other friends went back to Bali, and Aki and I stayed there another 3.5 weeks until
wow.
the day came. And I wasn't about to leave, but what I ended up getting was gold, you know, best footage I think I've ever shot of Aki.
And in the moment when it all comes together and you've got the athlete, you've got the conditions, you've got the shot, how does that make you feel as a filmmaker? For all those, it's like when we surf, you know, for the 38 terrible surfs, for the one surf, it fills you with something. What does it fill you with when you nail something special and everything comes together, the wind, the tide, the athlete, the film, the conditions, the sun? What's that like?
You have to remember that through Tubular Swells all the way through to the Billabong Challenge, was 1995, I was the only cameraman on my shoots. I was the guy who had to get it all. And so I would clean all my camera gear religiously every night, just have all the lenses perfect, everything, so it's locked and loaded, ready to go the next day. Like, I'll tell you a great shot. We're at the Billabong Challenge, right? And Kelly gets there and he talks about this right-hander that Tom Carroll told him about. And then we have this first morning and I say to everybody, okay, I'll see you guys up at the point, Narlu. And I'm there and no Kelly and no Sonny and no Shane Powell. And then I go, I bet you those guys took off to go look at that right. So I jump in my car. I leave my film crew down there. This is when I started working with different people. And I race to the top of this cliff, and sure enough, they're out there surfing. I put my camera and everything together, and I shoot a shot from the top of the hill. And then in between a set, I run down the hill and I can see this set coming, but I got to get a good spot. And so I'm standing on the steep side of the hill and I stick my camera legs down on the downhill side and pull the back leg in and stuff it into the cliff. And then you have to level your thing. And I bubble, you know, lick my bubble and get the thing. And then, oh, I turn my camera like this and Kelly Slater's taking off. And he gets this wave that's just classic. And for the next 3 or 4 weeks, all I can do is hold my breath until I sit in that transfer room and see if I got the shot, because I don't even know if I got it, because it's like,
yeah,
it's like, oh my God, you know, everything happens so quick. But anyway, I got it. And those are the things, those are the shots that you look forward to. There's water shots, like Laird's shot, Laird riding that wave of his. I knew I got it.
So Jack's talking about Laird Hamilton. I presume you're talking about it, Chopu, yeah?
The Millennium Wave.
The Millennium Wave. So tell me, we'll stick to this idea of brief thoughts. Why is it called the Millennium Wave, for those that won't be aware?
It was a wave at the turn of the century where Laird Hamilton broke the sound barrier of big wave surfing. Because up until then, surfers were paddling into waves. Laird had been working with a couple of guys for a couple of years with jet-assisted takeoff, tow surfing. And he rode a wave that had never been ridden or believed you could ride before, because you can't catch a freight train on a bicycle, you know?
It's a great description.
You can't catch a freight train on a bicycle, but you need to match power with power, and so they're using jet skis.
And you in the water for that shot?
No.
You're on a boat or on the land?
I'm on a jet ski.
You're on a jet ski.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's an incredible shot, but that was what I was going to ask you about next. When you are in the water and you are trying to capture the moment and you've got your camera and your water housing, Jack, and it's big surf, and you know, like I look at some of the stuff you've shot and it's like, yeah, that's an enormous wave. What's it like being out there and putting yourself in the position to get the shot when there's some concerns about safety? Like, you've grown up in Hawaii, you're a waterman, but how do you prepare to go out when it's freaking massive?
You know, I was taught early in the piece to just don't race out there. You know, when you go to a place like the one day at Chopu, I had to keep reminding myself to stay focused. We were witnessing things that you hadn't seen before. I hadn't seen before. Laird hadn't seen before. Laird rode a wave unlike any other wave in the world on instinct. Now, as you know, when you're backside, you have to spend all your time focused on holding your inside rail with your heels.
Yep.
You're trying to hold onto the face. Laird instinctively knew that if he did that, he was going to go up and over. And so he pointed his surfboard down into the trough where this water is draining off the reef. Like, you can see, it's just the whole reef is going dry. I'm sitting on a jet ski with a Tahitian guy named Poto, and I sit side saddle, and he has me inside the reef. All the boats and everybody are just outside the reef. And he's not even looking at the wave. He's looking at the bottom of the reef. As he putt, 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 putt idles me, I've got my shoulder in his back. I've got my legs spread. I'm getting my shot. And he's just slowly taking me up and over. This closeout is there. It grows. Now, we're about 50 feet inside of Laird. And he, that night when we're drinking the beer, he goes, I knew I was in a bad spot by the look on your face. What had happened was, is that I have a camera that doesn't have a reflex. So I used my right eye to frame my shot, but I used my left eye to see what's going on around me. When he took off, the left eye's going, hey, right eye, you can't believe what I'm seeing. Shut up, I'm busy. I have this conversation going back and forth between the left, and finally the left eye goes, right eye, you have to see what I'm seeing. And so I take my eye off the camera, move my camera sideways so I can look around the corner and see it, and then I go straight back. All that happened in 1 second. I let out a yell. I was just so overwhelmed by what I'd seen. And he had a chance to see me while he's riding this wave, everything else, and see me down there as well, go, ah, and come back. I knew I was in a bad spot by the look on your face.
That's a great story.
On these islands, the reefs often made it difficult to get ashore. But the Polynesians became expert watermen by navigating these reefs and channels, and when necessary, by riding through the surf on a carved piece of wood. They called this he'inalu, or wave riding.
Hey, Blue Horizon, talking about a couple of surfers. Blue Horizon, one of my favorite surf films, follows Andy Irons, very driven, multiple world champion who unfortunately is no longer with us, and Dave Rastovich, the sole surfer. So it's your surf to compete to your surf for lifestyle style of film.
Andy shreds in all conditions. In the past couple of years, he's focused his talents on winning. No one wants Andy Irons in their heat, and there's a very good reason why.
If you're into surfing, have a look at it. It's a great film. What was the intensity of Andy Irons like to capture on film?
You know, it was hard sometimes because he was gunning for a world title.
That is against Kelly. It's like one of the most fabled battles of all time, Irons Slater. It's as good as it gets in professional competition surfing, isn't it? Two very different personalities going bang, head to head, like confronting each other out of the water and amazing stuff.
Well, you couldn't have written a better script.
No.
I couldn't believe, you know, I followed Andy around for 2 years and I would follow the tour, then I'd take off and go work with Rasta, and I did this back and forth a fair bit. But with Andy, he never was able to actually have a free moment of time to go shoot with me in Rasta. But Andy was he was honest. And that's what I appreciated about him. You know, he gave me an honest portrayal, but he was a very sensitive human being. It was hard for him to not be this tough guy, you know, when he was a very beautiful, sensitive human being. And that's what I saw of him. And for some reason, he began to think that I'd stitched him up to make him look bad. And I just kept saying to him, Andy, what you have done is perform for me honestly. Thank you for allowing to be so honest. I could have made him look a lot gnarlier.
Right.
Believe you me, I had a lot of other footage, but that wasn't my objective. My objective was to show, and I just kept saying, John McEnroe, Michael Schumacher, you know, you don't get to be the top of your game by being a nice guy competitively. And it's okay. You know, nothing the matter with that, mate. And that's what it took you to win that second year's world title from a six-time world champion. And I had broken my ankle the week before I was supposed to go to Hawaii, and I didn't even know the end of my movie. And we were coming out on the 19th of January, and the contest is going from the 1st of December to the 24th of December or something. Oh. Was the waiting period. But the pipe was the last one, and it was ending Christmas Day. And I'm sitting back in Sydney, and back then all you got were the computer would show you the scores. All it had was like a live report of the scores only.
Yeah, of course.
It wasn't like a live broadcast. And I'm sitting there with my partner, my producer, Sinclair. And as soon as Andy won, I turned to him and we high-fived and we went, we have a movie.
You know, we have the ending.
We have a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty full on.
Let's get back to Jack. There was an ad that had an effect on me as a young man, Jack, and it was a Coca-Cola ad, and it's your classic kids running through a jungle with surfboards, and then they run out onto this beach, and there is this perfect wave, and the tagline was always offshore, always Coca-Cola. And like you, I run a business, a media business, and my incorporated in my company name is Always Offshore. So people think it sounds like a tax dodge, but it's not like a Panamanian company. It goes back to it goes back to watching that Coca-Cola ad where, you know, they've discovered this new wave. Tell me a story on your travels about finding surfing perfection down a beaten track somewhere that's just been worth the boat ride or the plane ride or the malaria or the sickness or to walk out onto that beach and go, this is surfing nirvana.
I wasn't one of the first people to go to Grajagon, but I was one of the few people who went there in the early days. I'll never forget the day that we got picked up in Bali. We got in the back of the car at 10 o'clock at night. We drove all night to the ferry. We got off at the ferry, stretched our legs, got back in the back, slept all the way till we got to the village in Grajagon. We got on this ancient prow. I've got all this camera gear. These boats are not designed to go through or in from the surf. And I'm freaking out because there's a 4-foot sandbar river mouth that's smashing. And they don't have any power in these boats. They got a little propeller and it goes boom, 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 boom. And so we make it out. And then it's about an hour and a half, 2 hours, you know, motor ride till you come into this little tiny channel. And as you're coming in that channel, I can see it as clear now as I did the day I saw it. There's just donuts coming down the reef. It was overwhelming. It was like insane. And then you pull in the beach, you take your stuff up, and then you're living in these jungle tree houses, and there's tigers in the jungle and 20-foot boas and, you know, green mambas and, you know, stonefish, and where we're in the camp with 6 to 10 of our best friends, you know, and we'd spend a month there. And you'd get there and you'd throw your watch away, take your watch off. But it was like surfing heaven being there, because from as far up that way you could see to as far as you could see down that way, it was just this beautiful peeling wave. And that first vision of seeing Grajagon has to be one of the greatest experiences of my surfing life.
So nowadays, it's all computer generated, the way you edit it, you shoot everything digitally. But Jack, when you started, heavens above, what was involved in making a film?
When I started, you actually had to buy a film and take it out of its packet and put it in the camera and thread it up, close the door, shoot the film, put it in the camera in a black bag so it wouldn't expose the end of the roll, take the film out, put another roll in. You then had to process the film, and you physically had to do all that.
Mm.
I shot Perfect Days and I was slightly overexposed and it was useless. A School of Hard Knocks, And I got so good at reading a light meter that I could, after a couple of years, hold my hand up to the sun and see the amount of light that was falling on it, and got within that third of a stop. Okay, that's how you experience, you know, it's all about experience. There were so many things that could go wrong in that whole process. Then once you did that, you had to go conform the work print to your original. You had to do a sound mix and color grades and all that. Then you actually had a print that you took away and showed as a film. Now you shoot it, you come back, you click and drag and put the pictures together, and it's all there. And you spit it out onto a little hard drive, and this then becomes all you need.
Watching your films, you always see something new that you haven't seen before on a Jack McCoy film. So of all the different technology you've used, what is the best adaption you've come up with and you've thought, yep, this is going to be cracking in a surf movie?
For me, I'm happy to say that before my lungs gave out on me, I was able to get an underwater jet ski. And for years, I'd been sitting behind waves with my camera, waiting for something to go by to get a shot. Because to me, that's just as beautiful as it is in front of the wave, if not more beautiful. No one had ever done this before, tracking shots behind the wave. I made a clip. I had it in my movie, A Deeper Shade of Blue. I used a song by The Fireman, and a friend of mine, Chris Thomas, music producer, came out. He worked with the Beatles on the White Album and all that. And he goes, "What's the song you use?" I go, "It's The Fireman." He goes, "Who's The Fireman?" I go, "It's your buddy, Paul McCartney." 6 months later, I get a note from Chris, says, "Here, Paul wants to hook up with you. Dear Chris, I love what Jack did with The Fireman track. So much so, it's inevitably suitable to be married to a song I'm going to use next year called Blue Sway. If he's interested, let me know." And I made this clip, and make a long story short, I had a chance to go to London, show him the clip. And when he saw it, he turned to me and he went, "Magic, beautiful brother, you've blown my mind." And it's this vision that I've always dreamed of. But it's even more than that, because when I sit, I'm making a clip for a Beatle, I said, it has to be trippy. So I turned a lot of shots upside down and played them backwards.
Gotcha.
And Paul got it and won, you know. That to me is like my final signature out the door with this lung disease when my career is coming to an end. At least I got to do that. At least I got to do this underwater jet ski and capture images that I've been dreaming about for years.
So we normally finish this podcast the same way, Jack. We have a lot of young people listen to this show, which is great, that might be into filmmaking or surfing or tennis or cricket or science or maths or gardening, whatever it may be. You've obviously had tremendous success in your chosen field. What advice would you give to those young and inquiring minds that are hoping to achieve success in their field built on your experiences?
Nothing comes easy. First and most importantly is to have your heart in the right place. You know, put your goals and objectives in your heart. And like David Rasovich's dad says, think it, feel it, do it. Don't be afraid of hard work, because I worked so freaking hard carrying gear through the jungle and climbing mountains and trying to get a unique angle and do things. And there'd be a lot of times when I could have just not done it, said, "Oh, that's too hard." I never once said that's too hard. I always said, let's go for it. So be true to yourself. Set yourself a 1, 2, and 5-year goal. And work toward those goals. and celebrate them. Once you've reached those goals, celebrate them. Even if you do it with yourself or just your girlfriend, go out and have a nice meal and a bottle of champagne or something. But celebrate achieving your goals. And if you can't reach those goals, just know that experience is what you get when you don't get what you want.
It's a great answer, Jack. I've been looking forward to this since we made contact with each other. It's been a privilege to have you on the Howie Games Artist Series. Good luck to you and Oki with the tour of the film 25 Years On, the Ockumentary. It's been an absolute privilege for me, mate. You're a star.
And all I can say to you, Mark, is thank you so much for the opportunity to do this. It's been a pleasure having a yak with you. Aloha.
The famous expression, love what you do and do what you love, I reckon that's Jack McCoy right there. What a beauty. Thank you to Jack, and thanks to him for the amazing photo he sent me of Oki that is now up in my office. I love it. Another artist series coming your way very soon. Until then, you know the rest. Peace and love.